You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are outside the Mouteria in London's King's Cross. I've noticed on the menu, the cocktail menu in the Mouteria, the vermouth bar, that there's a Milano Torino cocktail. Got vermouth in it and various other ingredients.
Mate, sure, it warm us up because we've currently got blankets over our legs like old people. It's like the old people we are.
Temperature's dipped a bit, hasn't it, in London the last couple of days.
And how is it in Berlin? Ciao, come stai, Daniele Friberencini?
That's not too bad, actually. Yeah, it's a bit grey here today. The weather's been good recently, but yeah, it's quite grey in Berlin. And a few issues with sleep at the moment, chaps. you usually
you know we're recording.
You guys have frequently complained about insomnia in the past, not on the podcast, but privately. I've been experimenting with intermittent fasting, and I don't know whether that's the reason why I'm not sleeping at all. Anyway,
not sleeping at all.
Not really. No, hour or two a night. I've been listening to podcasts while to try and get me to
the cycling podcast.
No, not the cycling
going back
podcast.
Through the back catalogue.
no, but apart from that I'm okay.
No, you wouldn't fall asleep to that, would you? It's too entertaining. Well, Lionel, we've come to a pause. We've been traveling a lot, haven't we, the last week?
We certainly have. Week one of our grand tour took us from Bristol to Belfast, and then
who's in the jersey?
Sparkly leggings.
Wow,
actually.
That's it. Yeah, the leader's sparkly leggings were worn by Orla in Belfast on Friday night. Very memorable show. Great audience. Some great questions. Really, well, very close to a full house. I think it pretty much was a full house, wasn't it, at the Mac in Belfast. Great way to end a really good week of live events. Thank you everyone who came to see us. Really appreciate how many people turned up everywhere. And then a couple of days off at the weekend, and then we were back in action on Monday night at the Arts Theatre, weren't we, Richard, where we had Matt White, Mitchelton Scott sports director, came over. Extremely entertaining. A few comments that we probably couldn't broadcast.
Well, we'll have to probably leave it a few weeks before we broadcast some of them. But we will we'll hear from Matt White later on in this episode, actually. I sat down with him earlier in the day to talk about how they plan the season. Something I know you've always been interested in, Lionel, how that is actually done when you've got a roster of 29 or so riders and how many race days? 230 or something ridiculous. A big puzzle. So we'll hear from him on that later on in the episode. And Daniel, you are preparing to join us for week two, which kicks off on Monday at the Arts Theatre, where we will be joined also by Adam Blythe and Rod Ellingworth, who's obviously just taken over at Barry and Merida. Then we go to Cambridge, Edinburgh, Leicester and Manchester. All next week we'll be joined in Manchester again by Adam Blythe and
Ciro Scognamiglio.
Ciro Scognamiglio is joining us on Monday as well. A very few tickets left for Monday at the Arts Theatre and for Edinburgh at the Churchill Theatre. There's about 10 left in Edinburgh, so it's almost sold out. But go to thecyclingpodcast.com to get tickets to all these events. Pre-order our book as well while you're there. Looking forward to it, Daniel?
Yes, very much looking forward to travelling on the team bus, Rich. Very much looking forward to seeing whether you've prepared my rider. That I sent through a few weeks ago. You know, the
missed that
the open qualifying standard golf course that you were supposed to arrange around for me at in Scotland. Should be great.
Yeah, we're traveling by train actually, but it'll be good. I'm looking forward to it immensely. It's been great fun so far, and this week I think at home to rest is much needed, isn't it, Lionel?
Exhausting. It's a strange old rhythm, isn't it, being on the road, the travelling in the daytime, and then the kind of the nerves start bubbling up for me anyway in mid-afternoon, and then or the adrenaline shot of being in front of an audience, and then the late dinner, and well, a very truncated night's sleep a couple of times, not least because in Dublin we were staying in a hotel called the Harcourt Hotel, and if you're in Dublin you'll probably know that this is famously in a street which is basically dominated by nightclubs. The downstairs of our hotel was basically a nightclub until 3 a.m, and well, certainly my room and Orla's room were well, it was very, very noisy. And
if you can't beat them, join them, Lionel.
Well, no, I mean, I was quite tired by then, to be honest.
Wonderful moment in Belfast at the end when somebody who was queuing to buy a book introduced himself to Orla as the assistant manager of the Harcourt Hotel. She had obviously been posting about that on Instagram, and there was a moment there where she was taken in by that. Very, very funny indeed. But big thanks to Orla and Francois Thomasot for joining us last week. And Francois sang the Marseillaise every night. So looking for similar from you next week, Daniel. I don't know what song you've got up your sleeve, but
what anthem would you like me to sing?
Italian, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Well, they'll be caused to sing the Italian anthem on Monday, won't they, with Ciro making a cameo appearance.
There's a promise. Let's hear a little montage from our live shows last week now, shall we, chaps? I think we've got recordings from Belfast, Worcester and Cardiff.
You may not know this, although I'm sure this has gone down in cycling folklore here, but Richard Moore rode the Tour of the North many times and, in fact, was King of the Mountains at the Tour of Ulster. In what year was that, Richard?
1996, I think. 96 or 97.
There was a start of a clap there. We'll go with that. Although you were checking out your pro, can you imagine this? You were checking out your pro cycling stats on the train up from Dublin earlier. And there's no record of it. Of all of his Palmares, there is no Grand Tours, no One Day Classics.
Well, didn't ride anything.
That's very true. The one entry in pro cycling stats for Richard Moore is Commonwealth Games. DNF. Did not finish. Quite unfair, I thought.
Yeah, but pro cycling stats only started after I'd finished, so they're still, you know.
I found actually Richard Moore in Cid du Cyclisme, which is a Dutch site with lots of riders, but there's a Richard Moore. He's from Australia.
And he won stuff, so.
But following on from the least deserved round of applause ever, this evening is all about Orla Shenouy, very much your homecoming stage, the one you've been targeting ever since the route was announced earlier this year. But I have to say, I'm feeling very much at home here too, because at lunchtime, I had a very nice curry in our hotel restaurant, and it came with rice, naan bread and chips, the triple whammy. So yeah, this is the place for me. This, of course, 1989, Greg LeMond's team jersey from the Tour de France, Sean Kelly's jersey from his years at Cass, of course, Robert Miller and Greg LeMond wore the Zed Peugeot jersey, very striking. I have no idea what this is. Somebody called R. Moore of Australia won the Tour of Speyside one year.
Lionel, where's the US postal kit that you wore to write up Alpe d'Huez on that occasion?
I burnt it in the garden.
As we wander around the team buses in Henley, someone remarks that today's stage includes the longest continual climb in the UK. I say. A woman taps me briskly on the shoulder. I thought I recognised you. You're from the podcast, yes? Bugger, I've done it again. I'm relieved when we get on the road. I have nothing against poshness per se, but it has always made me quite uncomfortable, as does the kind of countryside idyll that English people seem so fond of. Rolling hills, quaint stone buildings, perfect fences. There is something about supposed perfection of any kind that makes me deeply uneasy. As we sit down to a mid-stage refreshment stop in the most charming tea room you could imagine, Richard comes up with a theory. You're uncomfortable with posh, Orla, because you are posh. Easy. What? I'm not posh, sorry, Mum and Dad. I protest. The actual posh ladies in the tea room bristle. I need to get out of here.
If you really want me to sing...
I love how you've changed microphones and everything. Reluctant.
It changes everything, doesn't it? Yeah, so that if you listen to the podcast, you might have heard it, the lounge version of La Marseillaise, but it went something like that. Allons enfants de la patrie, jour de gloire est arrivé. Contre nous de la tyrannie, l'étendard sanglant élevé, l'étendard sanglant élevé. Entendez-vous dans nos campagnes mugir ces féroces soldats qui viennent jusque dans nos bras, égorger nos fils et nos compagnes. Aux armes, citoyens, formez vos bataillons, marchons, marchons, qu'un sang impur abreuve nos sillons.
Any news this week, Lionel?
We've been scooped by a fellow podcaster this morning. Ned Bolting has the news that Steve Cummings is retiring at the age of 38. He was riding for Dimension Data, of course, this season. His last race was stage 5 of the Tour of Britain, which went from Birkenhead to Birkenhead, and being a lad from Merseyside, that was very much his home stage. And unfortunately he crashed with 50 kilometres to go and ended up in hospital, had to have an operation, I think, and it fractured vertebrae. A disappointing end to what has been a long and at times very successful career. Who can forget the stage win that Cummings had at Mond in the Tour de France a few years ago, when he completely outfoxed the French, didn't he, on the run-in in the airfield there? And equally memorably, the win at Lac de Payol the following year, 2016. And that was the day when the kilometre to go banner, was it the kilometre to go banner, fell.
It was one of the banners.
It was
fell
one of the
Adam
big
Yates,
inflatable banners, collapsed onto Adam Yates. But Steve Cummings had got through and won that stage. He also won the Tour of Britain, of course, and he really made his speciality was sitting towards the back of the peloton and waiting for the opportunities and carefully selecting his opportunities to get in breaks. But a very successful career. He was both road and time trial national champion. He rode the Commonwealth Games. And I remember way back in 1999, 20 years ago this summer, he won the Eddie Soans Memorial handicap race at Aintree up in Liverpool. And that's a handicap race, and he's still the only junior to have won that event. And later on that year he won the National Junior Road Race Championship somewhere in the Midlands. I was there that day, and my two memories are of seeing Robert Miller, who was one of the national coaches I think at the time, running up the hill to go and chat to Steve Cummings, who just won the national title. So yeah, a long career comes to an end, and Ned has the scoop.
Yeah, he also featured in our How to Retire episode last year for Friends of the Podcast, because he had started studying as well as still riding his bike with a view to what he was going to do after retiring.
It's been interesting, chaps, to sort of observe from afar the sort of process that he's gone through over the last couple of years. I've spoken to him a lot at races in the past 2 or 3 years, and from sort of the 2016 Dauphiné, when he was at the back end of this kind of purple patch where he was winning a stage basically of every World Tour stage race that he was taking part in, very much in the same fashion, in sort of long range breaks and ending up winning on his own, then segued in 2017, which wasn't quite so good, and then the last couple of years you've had a real sense that he was trying to figure out what his place still was, if he did have a place still in the peloton. There was quite a telling, I suppose, maybe poignant moment in the Tour de France this year in Po. There was a time trial in Po, and obviously, you know, Steve's own issues with health and form over the last couple of years. The backdrop to that has been, well, the struggles of his team, Dimension Data. And this year, there was a lot of uncertainty about whether he would or would not go to the Tour de France. And he was pretty much picked at the last minute and consequently hadn't really prepared in the way that he would have liked. But one thing he had worked on was that he thought he could, you know, kind of concentrate on, was his time trialing. And he expected, I think, to do quite a good ride that day, and he came over the line, and this often happens at the end of time trials. Riders don't really know how well they've done, and I was going to interview Steve for ITV, but I think before the camera sort of rolled, he asked me how he'd done, And I think the time gap from whoever was first at the time was about 2.5 minutes. And I told him this, and I could see that he was sort of visibly taken aback. And it was almost a kind of penny dropping in that split second. And he sort of said to me, well, you know, blimey, I'm not as good as I think I am anymore, or I'm not as good as I thought I was anymore. And it was almost as though, you know, as I say, in that moment, and certainly over the course of the Tour de France, he realised that his best was no longer quite as good as it had been a couple of years earlier, and his decline had really started and was probably going to be inexorable from that point.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Ratha in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Very grateful to them, as ever, for their support of the cycling podcast. And the other big news, I mean, as you said, Lionel, not an awful lot of news in the last week. Another retirement, Daniele Benatti, the Movistar veteran sprinter, is retiring.
He started 25 Grand Tours, Benatti.
25 Grand Tours.
Finishing 16 of them. That's quite... and he's won a stage in each, the Giro, the Tour, and the Vuelta. 25 Grand Tours, that's quite a career.
Very effective at reinventing himself, wasn't he, Benatti? He was sort of the Kylie Minogue of the pro peloton. He had a few different
incarnations.
He should
be so lucky.
Yeah. His locomotion initially was mainly observed in sprint.
Come on, Lionel, your turn.
In sprint finishes. He was probably the most, well, just about the most promising sprinter around when he started his career, first couple of years. But then he became much more of a sort of road captain in his latter years, and he was also a lead-out man at various times, a breakaway specialist.
Kylie's first number one was I Should Be So Lucky. Benatti didn't finish any of his first four Grand Tours, so... Not sure your analogy works, Daniel.
Well, Lionel, yeah. It was especially for you, that analogy. So,
I thought he and Movistar would be together forever. But anyway, this is terrible. Bernie Eisel, I mean, the couple of other writers from Dimension Data, Steve Cummings has retired. Bernie Eisel, don't know yet. I think he is looking for another team, but currently without a team and maybe forced into retirement. Enrico Gasparotto, the veteran Italian, well, he's now Swiss. He's lived in Switzerland for a while, and he will be able or eligible to compete for Switzerland next year at the Olympic Games and World Championships. Bernie Eisel, any news on him, Daniel?
No, actually, Rich. I knew for a while before Mark Cavendish's signing with Bahrain Merida was announced that he wasn't going with Cavendish to Bahrain Merida. I know that he wanted to do another season at least as a pro rider, but no news on that front at the moment.
I mean, the other news that's still rumbling on is the ongoing tribunal into Dr. Richard Freeman. We talked about that in last week's episode, and we were recording last week after Shane Sutton's evidence. Unfortunately, he didn't quite last a day. He was supposed to be 2 days up in front of the tribunal. Shane Sutton stormed out, so the Mary O'Rourke, the QC to Richard Freeman, didn't get to put all her questions to him, which is perhaps unfortunate. Since then, we've had Phil Burt, the physiotherapist, who was the man. I mean, the hearing into Richard Freeman, it concerns a lot of charges against him. I think 19 of the 22 charges have already been admitted by him, but he's contesting a few of them. And one in particular, which concerns us and cycling fans most of all, relates to the delivery of Testogel back in 2011, a banned substance, obviously. A £50 order from Fit for Sport, the regular nutritional supplier to British Cycling, arrived at Velodrome. It was intercepted by Phil Burt, the physiotherapist, who, on discovering it, took it to Steve Peters, the head of medicine, who happened to be with Richard Freeman at the time. And Phil Burt apparently reacted with horror to this. And I understand his first thought on opening it was, we're being set up here, I believe, and he reported to Steve Peters. Steve Peters told Richard Freeman said it had been delivered in error, and Peters told him to send it back. Now, it turns out now that it hadn't been delivered in error. We still we're no further forward. I mean, we expect to hear from Freeman. I understand Freeman will be appearing at the tribunal this week. He was unable to appear last week, but he apparently will appear this week. The number of scenarios are possible. That it was for Sutton, as Richard Freeman claims, that it was for Freeman, as Steve Peters suggested, or that it was for a rider, as the GMC maintain. And each of these scenarios is possible. We don't know which one is true. The key thing is, if it was for a rider, then it's a doping offence.
I think the thing that struck me most from last week's hearings, other than sort of the explosive and almost pantomime cartoonish appearance by Shane Sutton, and of course we're going on just the written accounts, and of course we had Tom Carey as well on last week's podcast. He was at the hearing just painting a picture for us. It sounds explosive and extraordinary, but the thing once the dust had settled was, once again, Richard Freeman was too unwell to appear and take questions. The other thing was Dr. Steve Peters, the head of medical at British Cycling during this period, basically saying that he felt like he was trying to solve a case in which the two principal witnesses, Dr. Freeman and Shane Sutton, are both at best unreliable and at worst lying. And that really struck me, because when did that kind of occur to Dr. Steve Peters, that those were the kinds of people that were working in the organisation that he was working in? I mean, each strand of this seems to suggest further questions. And as I said in last week's podcast, and possibly didn't explain what I was meaning quite well enough, when I said that it felt like a missed opportunity, I wasn't criticising Mary O'Rourke, Dr. Freeman's QC, because her job is very different she's trying to do a job that's very different to just finding out exactly what happened. She's trying to defend Dr. Freeman and get the best possible outcome for her client. Whereas as an observer from the outside, it would be great to think that somebody at some point is going to lay out all of the evidence and put all of the evidence to test. And whether that will happen in this tribunal, I don't know. But the other question is whether UK anti-doping will pick this up after the conclusion of the tribunal, if we don't get to the bottom of things. So it's still, as far as I can see, as clear as mud, really.
Yeah, and it's really about the charge sheet against British Cycling and Team Sky over the sort of history of their success and how much is added to that charge sheet. Already, I think there's strong evidence which has been augmented during this case that the recruitment at Team Sky and to a certain extent British Cycling was sloppy and didn't live up to the promises that sort of came with the sales pitch of this team these organisations that showed incredible attention to detail. We know that because of the various riders the various directors sportifs and staff that had to be let go by Team Sky when they did have a clear out, when they had this sort of, well, it wasn't really an amnesty, was it a sort of a truth and reconciliation process, because the individuals lost their job, the likes of Stephen de Jong and Bobby Julik, who admitted that they'd used doping products during their career and they were subsequently let go. So then you add in the likes of Geert Landers, the Belgian doctor, who we know was also at Team Sky in 2011. The sort of sloppiness of the recruitment, and you would have to question now whether Richard Freeman should have been in a job there, and Shane Sutton certainly, based on some of the stories we're hearing about him. Although I would also stress, and as we've emphasised before on the podcast, there are those, and there are many athletes who have worked with Shane Sutton in the past who would say that for all his vices and for all that his techniques probably didn't belong in a sort of 21st century coaching setup, he was very talented at getting the best out of athletes in the right circumstances, in certain circumstances. So that's one issue. But I suppose the thing that's really struck me watching it from afar, chaps, is how much emotion people have invested in this case going a certain way. I think, you know, we all have to be honest with ourselves, and everyone does have to be honest with themselves and ask themselves, you know, are there temporary conclusion, provisional conclusions being coloured by what they hope is the final outcome of this? And I do think a lot of people want to see the whole British Cycling Team Sky story edifice crumble, and that's leading to some hasty conclusions. You know, in the interest of complete transparency, what do I think about the whole organisation and the whole story at this point in time? Well, my intuition is kind of changeable about it. It's amorphous. At this moment in time, I think, you know, there were aspects of it that were sloppy. I think that there was a line. They had a line that they didn't want to go over as far as doping, as far as medicine was concerned. But that line was maybe not in the place where members of the public thought that that line was, or in the place where maybe Dave Brailsford had suggested it would be. So, you know, they were going to stay within the law, but it was going to be their interpretation of the law. However, my intuition is still that we don't have enough evidence to suggest that there was some wide-ranging doping program, or even that there was any kind of doping program in the sense of, you know, using testosterone to enhance, for example, a team leader's performance in the Tour de France. But, you know, that, as I said, that's very much a provisional conclusion. And I think it's, you know, from our point of view, it's important to be right, not to be the first, or not to be quick to make judgments about this. We have to be patient, and I think unfortunately everyone else has to be patient as well. The facts kind of reveal themselves, you know, as more information becomes available and as this case in particular goes on. I just wince slightly when, you know, I see people make the leap from, okay, this all looks a little bit amateurish, and, you know, there are obviously disagreements and obviously politics, to it's all a facade and marginal gains. What we, you know, the term that we journalists have actually used probably more than the actors themselves, the Dave Brailsfords and so on, that's all complete rubbish and bunkum. You know, I saw a blog or an article written by someone whose opinion I actually very much respect, Steve Magnus, the athletics coach who worked with Alberto Salazar and sort of became a whistleblower in athletics. But, you know, he's not a cycling specialist, and he wrote a pretty measured piece in the last week, I think, sort of suggesting that maybe the marginal gains and what had been talked about as marginal gains were kind of emperor's new clothes. But, you know, we've had hundreds of conversations with people over the last 10 years, over the lifespan of Team Sky, who have no real reason to extol the virtues of you know, the technology, the know-how, the savoir-faire that they have been using, but have done so and continue to do so. And you know, that doesn't mean that if someone mentioned the fact they drink pineapple juice in an interview, that doesn't mean that is a game changer. But for example, the fact that there were times when they spent 10 more days at altitude than other teams in a season, that might have changed the outcome of races. And, you know, of 100 things that they maybe try to do differently from other teams, maybe only 15 did have an effect. But there was also a big placebo effect. And you know, and I also think that over the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen teams catch up, and it's got harder for Team Sky to or what's now Ineos to employ and gain an advantage from those minor details that maybe did bring them advantages in the first few years.
But at the heart of this, as Richard said from the beginning, is it really, this is a story of a breakdown in relationships, a falling out. And I think back over the 20 years I've been covering the sport, and think there's a sense of inevitability with that when Shane Sutton is concerned. Now, you know, it's easy to sound wise after the event, but I mean, I've never worked in elite sport. I don't know firsthand the kind of environments, you know, the level of sacrifices required, the sort of the abrasive, you know, sometimes love hate relationships. But I can kind of imagine, you know, just from, you know, the way that another sport that I follow, football, works. You know, managers who, well, Sir Alex Ferguson, one of the best in the business, you know, kicking a boot across a room and across a dressing room so it hits David Beckham above the eye, or, you know, to give the hairdryer treatment. These things are, they're almost glamorized, glorified as being part of the operating manual for people who want to drive sports people to greater performances. And I think Shane Sutton was an abrasive character. He's someone who, you know, his bite can be as bad as his bark sometimes. I always had the feeling that he would have favourites. You know, there are athletes who've spoken very highly of the way that Sutton has worked with them over the years, certainly in the British Cycling Olympic program. But there are also people, you know, one or two people I know who barely want to mention his name in regard to their own achievements, and who suffered through for the sakes of their own careers, despite Shane Sutton, not because of Shane Sutton. And I think that the thing that puzzles me, I suppose, is, you know, the fact that both in Team Sky and in British Cycling, Sutton's methods, good, bad, indifferent, were tolerated because for a period they got results. And I think that that's the kind of the uncomfortable truth when we get to the end of all of this, is that a culture was allowed to operate because it was successful. And, well, we've seen there can be very little coincidence, surely, that as soon as Shane Sutton was sacked for effectively misconduct, you know, that things, the cards started to tumble.
But what a lot of people said about British Cycling, somebody I spoke to yesterday, quite, you know, involved in the staff there, said that when Dave Brailsford and Steve Peters were there at British Cycling, Shane was, I quote, manageable. Mm. And it was really when those two left that things unraveled very spectacularly. When Shane became the man in charge, with nobody managing him, keeping him on a leash, things did unravel, and we saw how that unraveled. And you know, he was sacked for bullying in effect, and for sexism and all the rest of it. That's what he lost his job over. So that's not a revelation. That's not, you know, that wasn't something we learned last week in the tribunal. We knew that already.
We did, but while it was getting results and no one was speaking out, it was all, in inverted commas, fine, wasn't it? And I think that's the bit that will, when all of this is digested, that's the bit that might sit least comfortably with a lot of people.
We but have to confront that scale, that 1 to 10 scale. It doesn't exist in reality. People are not at either ends of that scale. I mean, even Shane Sutton.
No, of course not. And also, you know, harsh, being spoken to harshly. Some people react differently. You know, some people don't particularly mind. Some people it works and it spurs them on, and some people, you know, don't enjoy that. And I think that the problem is that if you have a kind of one size fits all culture, well, you know, Shane Sutton's way or the highway probably wasn't sustainable.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Harry's. And you can get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. It's an appealing company to me, Harry's, even though I don't actually use their product.
You say that, Lionel, but you were clean shaven quite recently. You experimented.
Not quite. Sort of stubbly. Stubbly, but
not quite egg-like.
No, thanks, Richard. Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who are fed up with the price of razors They started Harry's, and they knew that the only way they could ensure the quality they wanted was to buy their own factory. So their business model is based on just taking a bit less profit for themselves, but still offering high quality razors for a fair price. And well, you can test out the Harry's trial set and judge for yourself with the weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip, rich lathering shave gel, and the travel blade cover. Richard, you were smooth, and lower half of your face was egg-like.
Yeah, well, I've been using them ever since they began their association with the Cycling Podcast. So, very happy customer. And if you do want to take that next step, Lionel, having experimented with the stubbly look, I can recommend them.
So, maybe I will. Maybe I will.
Do it. Do it for our shows next week.
I'd feel a bit naked on stage if I was completely egg-like. Support the podcast and get your trial set delivered to you. You'll get the razor handle, the 5 blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and travel blade cover. And go to harrys.com/cycling. That's harrys.com/cycling. Go there right now and you can get your trial set for just £3.95.
Well, just before we hear from Matt White, who joined us on stage at the Arts Theatre earlier this week, got a couple of other things coming up. The November episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is out later this week. That includes an interview with Cecilie Utrup-Ludwig and also a kind of retrospective feature on the Bols Dolmans team. The two sponsors are pulling out and the team's future is a little bit uncertain, and they have been the best team in the world, probably the greatest ever women's cycling team. We look back on the team's history to date with some former riders, current rider, that's Christine Majerus, and the team boss, Danny Stamm. And that's interesting, I think. So that's myself, Rose Manley, and Orla Chenoui with the Cycling Podcast Femina. Next week will be the latest episode of Service Course by the Cycling Podcast with Tom Wally and Lizzie Banks. And
Rich, in that feature on Bols Dolmans, you mentioned the fact that from January 1st, I read this yesterday, the speed limit on Dutch motorways is going to be 100 kilometres an hour. Did you mention that?
Didn't mention that, no. Is that relevant?
Well, no, not really. Well, yeah, there's a tenuous link, you know, the Netherlands.
It's a Dutch team, I'll give you that.
Extraordinary stuff. I felt I had to mention that. I was so taken aback by that, I thought I'd save it for this week's podcast and, you know, sort of gauge your reaction to it. And the most extraordinary thing about it is that public officials in the Netherlands have been quoted as saying they're well aware that there'll probably be more accidents because people will be bored and they'll be on their phones.
Extraordinary stuff. What's that in miles though, Daniel? That's the important
60
thing.
Miles an hour.
I'm joking, of course I know. It is, Netherlands is a country we admire for its cycling culture. And actually, one of the interesting things in that little feature on Bols Dolmans, Lucy Martin only rode for the team for a year, but she was very interesting on the kind of Dutch culture around cycling and around women's cycling in particular. And from what she says, it's no accident or coincidence that Dutch women riders have consistently been the best in the world, because it sort of links to the discussion we're having just before the break about British cycling. It sounds like a very, very harsh and performance oriented culture. It sort of took her by surprise, but she also feels that she gained from it personally. But again, it might not work for everybody. So we're going to hear from Matt White now, sports director at Mitchelson Scott, of course. And I sat down with him the other day just to ask him about the process of planning the season. How do you allocate riders to races? Partly this was inspired by I shared a car with him at the Tour of Lombardy, where he was talking to his fellow sports directors about races that were coming up and how they were going to fill the roster, because they had riders who were injured or who had finished their seasons already, and it seemed like a very complicated sort of jigsaw puzzle. So I was keen to know how they plan the whole season from, I suppose, the winter onwards. Here's what he said. So Matt, we're in the off season. I imagine one of the big tasks for you is planning for next year. How does that process start? You've got 28-29 riders, I don't know how many you've got for next year. How on earth do you begin to allocate them to races?
Yeah, I think it all starts, I build a calendar, it's getting earlier every year. This year I built it before the Tour de France, well before the Tour de France, for next year. Just, you know, you've got a pretty good idea of who's staying, who's going, and then it helps me to look for the guys we're going to buy for the year after. And then you're looking for the gaps in the calendar where you need some reinforcements. Then once you've got that final couple of guys signed, and look, these days, I think the last couple of years we've all been done by before the tour started. I can't remember who was the last one who signed this year, probably Andre Zeitz, and I'm pretty sure he was done pre-Tour de France. So back in the day, people used to start signing at the tour, but I think those days are long gone. Okay, so there you've got your roster, you've got your calendar, and then because I have been doing this role for every year in this team, I've got a good idea of what the guys are capable of doing, and then, you know, you have discussions with your sponsor or your general manager, and you can nut out what the focuses are for the team, and then you build a calendar around that, and I obviously start with our key guys, having discussions with those guys already mid-season, towards the end of the season last year. You know, sometimes you wait for the route of the tour and the Giro to come into play, but yeah, if you go after something, I think you go after it. I think the course is the course, and you've got to adapt to that, but every team's different. And then, yeah, start planning away, and then you've got to fill the gaps there with all the races that are non-World Tour, the Spanish races and smaller races. You've got to, you know, usually you've got a relationship with the organiser there, write to the organiser, or they've written to you and ask and confirm your participation. A couple of the Spanish races, chase a little bit of owed money from the years prior, and basically threaten we're not coming back until you pay us 2018 and 19 participation fee, and then you're away. And then what I do is I'll build a calendar, and then I'll send that to the coaches, get some feedback from the coaches, and it doesn't always fit perfectly as well. You've got to make some adjustments. We had our camp in October, the week of Lombardy, and you know, where we sit down with each of the riders and ask them what they'd like to chase next year. Usually, I can pick it pretty good. There was a couple of guys this year that went for a Grand Tour that I didn't expect, which means that I had to adjust my planning. And strangely enough, you know, one key guy who wants a little bit of a different race program, that affects a lot of other people because you're booting people out from. You have to prioritise, and you know, one little change does make a difference, and that's when you've got the calendar set. That's before the season starts, and obviously once the season starts, it's a jigsaw puzzle, mixing and matching with injuries, illnesses, and whatever may change your schedule.
I imagine a jigsaw puzzle where the pieces are kind of constantly moving around, and how, to what extent are the riders, I mean, I'm imagining that there are certain riders on the team who you are able to tell you, these are the races I want to do. How far down does that go in terms of, you know, the calibre of the rider? At what point does a rider have to fit into your schedule rather than the other way around? Or do you give each rider the opportunity to maybe say, I'd like to do a certain race? Or is it more fluid than that?
Yeah, look, it is. It's really individual based. And look, even our big guys, they might want a race calendar, but if we think as a team it's actually, you know, there's negotiation as well, you know. And there's not too many times where you're going directly against what some of the riders want. Some guys, strangely, want different calendars. Maybe not the Tour de France, or maybe not the Giro. And with the young guys, yeah, look, honestly, you don't give them much choice because, you know, we're paid to manage their career, especially the early years, you know. And especially with the young guys, you might have an idea of what they're capable of, and I'm very cautious in the first year or two. Until you get to know a rider, I'll give them a pretty light program, and I'll only chalk the program a bit harder if I can see they're handling it mid-season. So all our guys, I'm in the midst now of writing to all our guys and giving them a calendar up until July, and then I meet with all the riders either in Switzerland, Dauphiné, or Slovenia again, and then give them, because by middle of the year we've locked our Tour de France team in, we've got a much better idea for our Vuelta team, and then for the young guys, I understand, okay, just keep them on a light program, or some guys might be improving at a rate of knots. The eights is when they came through, and they need to be moved onto a harder program for the second half of the season.
And what, I mean, how do you do this? What do you use? Excel? You know, do you have a document on your computer that you're always tinkering with, and is that shared with other sports directors and general manager as well?
Yeah, definitely. Look, I've got a live document which only I can edit. but which is good because it is a pretty complicated. It's 240 race days with 28 athletes. We have one for the riders, and then we have obviously other ones for staff and vehicle movements, which is a crazy one. Fleet of vehicles we're moving around, but the people who have access to my calendar, I have the other six sport directors, the general manager, media team, and the head soigneur, the head mechanic as well. So the doctors haven't got access. The doctors don't need that. They want to know something, they'll ask me.
And do you enjoy that? I mean, is it a process that you quite like?
I really do. I do. I spend a lot of time on the calendar. And what I do is I also put notes into those races of what we're chasing. So it's clear when the directors go to that race, they can go back and look at the individual rider plans and the team plans. So we've got a clear goal of when you're building it. I build the teams, and then the other sports directors go and take over from there and chase those goals or targets we've set for that race.
And I mentioned, I heard, obviously, it maybe gets more complicated towards the end of the year when guys are tired or injured or out for other reasons. They've maybe ended their season early. And I think towards the end of this year, I think every team is limping towards the end of the season, aren't they? And that sounded very complicated. You were having a conversation with the other sports directors about how you would even fill the roster for some races.
Yeah, we were travelling pretty good all year. And look, in our team, our guys race less than any World Tour team because of our sponsors. You know, French teams have to do all the French races, Belgium teams have to do all the Belgian races. So the races we choose, they're really... there's no pressure from Scott to us for race's sake. So my riders will... I think I looked at the end of last year, there isn't a rider in the top 100 riders' race days in my team. So I think the maximum this year was 75, and a lot of guys averaging in the 60s. And what we're seeing is more specific targeted training and less days of competition. But we had a bad run the last week of the season. I think we lost three guys out with injury in the week pre-Lombardy, which then put us in a bit of a hole for Guangxi and Japan Cup and Lombardy. And because I'd already had guys on holidays for 3 weeks, I wasn't going to bring a guy back into racing who'd already had 2 or 3 weeks off, and guys were already on holidays in exotic locations. So we did very much limp through our last couple of weeks. But I think most teams were in the same boat, and most teams used stagiaires to fill the gaps. And even with our stagiaires, we had three, and it was all hands on deck for that last couple of weeks.
Is that difficult for the team, I guess, for the guys left who are shouldering a bigger burden, but also with the race organisers, and we're talking about ASO and people like that, are those tricky conversations that you have to have?
Yeah, look, what I do, the guys who start in January in Australia are starting at 100%, so I deliberately shut those guys' seasons down early. So no one who rides Tour and Under went past the World Championships, and a lot of those guys finished in Canada or even before, so those guys were already on a month, nearly ready to get back on the bike. So obviously if we're going to be winning a World Tour race in the second week of January, you're not racing in the middle of October. So the guys who did have to fill the gaps, they're the guys who started a little bit later or had a big mid-season break or come off the welter and were still running with some form. So we manage.
And you mentioned that, next season's almost done. I mean, you started that document before the tour. Are you find you're tinkering with it even at the tour, or is your mind fully focused on the tour?
It was fully focused on the tour because I knew we were pretty much locked. We had one spot we were going to keep. So, yeah, it was fully focused. But in between the Giro and the tour, it's a busy period. And I remember in the past, I'd always do it after the tour. And because of the market is getting so early now, it was the last thing I really felt like doing in between the Giro and the tour, and then popping into those three races and building a calendar. And it was just a necessity. Otherwise, you miss the boat because the teams are getting in early and investing in talent for the season after.
I guess when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about guys like Mikel Nieve, and Trentin's gone now, but those guys who aren't perhaps out and out leaders, but they can win races, they're very talented. How do you manage them? How do you give them enough opportunities to keep them sort of rewarded or incentivized for those, while also depending on them in the team roles that they do.
Yeah, I think it's all about relationships with those guys. Well, it's relationships with everyone. If you don't give a young guy what he perceives as a calendar where he thinks he's getting the opportunities, either he will look or he'll get pushed from a manager to look elsewhere. So the smallest and the youngest guys are just as important as the biggest guys. And I think if we look at the amount of races we've won over the last 7 years, this year was 35, but it was from 11 or 12 different people. So we're not a team that is very, we've got our leaders, but I think the most wins this year was 5 or 6 from per rider. I think it was Adam Yates and Trentin had 5 wins each, and then Darryl Impey. But there was lots of guys who won races, and there's no one in this team who can put their hand up and say, I didn't get a chance to go for a win. If they didn't, they didn't go looking for it hard enough. And I think that's the reason why we've got one change for next year, and we haven't had too many changes in general.
Is that something you're happy about? I mean, is that a sign of a settled team, a well-balanced team that you're happy with?
Yeah, look, sometimes you've got to freshen up the roster, and we've had to do that the last couple of years because we've just had some older riders. So you know, at the end of the day, you've got to move them on. It's great that someone like Michael Albasini can do 8 years with this team and finish at 40 years of age and Tour of Switzerland, but it doesn't work for everyone. And I think if you go a season or two long with some of those older guys, you've missed that next wave. And you've always got to be thinking, I'm thinking of getting results for next year, but I'm always thinking of what have we got in 2021? Or who's our next wave of GC guys, our next wave of classics guys? And it's a weird sport in the fact that there's not too many teams who have got sponsorship for more than 2 years, 3 years. So everything you're planning is all hypothetical, that your team still exists in 3 years' time. And it's a weird way to work, but that's the model that cycling has unfortunately created, and that's, you've got to work within those boundaries.
I mean, any news on the sponsorship front? I spoke to Jay Ryan about it at the Giro, and he said there'd been some meetings and so on. Well, at the same time, he's always said that there's no threat to the team at all, that he's happy to carry on supporting it. But is there any news that you're aware of?
Look, there's some things in the pipeline, and hopefully we can announce them for the start of next year. But as I said, we've got a very, very loyal owner. And I think what Jerry's looking for is, he wants to be involved in the team, but what he would love is just for us to find a sponsor that suits what we want to achieve, and it's sustainable, that we can have a sponsor for the next 5 to 10 years, and that he can take more of a backseat. But fortunately for us, he's been an incredible sponsor. And since we've lost Orica, he personally and Scott have really stepped up and enabled us to continue without a major key sponsor besides Jerry.
And next year, all about the Grand Tours again with the Yates brothers in particular.
Yeah, definitely. I think definitely for the Giro on the Tour, you might see a surprise for the Vuelta, but for the Giro on the Tour, I think we'll run a pretty similar template to 2019.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. Very much appreciated. And the 25% offer is still available at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Looking forward to seeing some people from Science and Sport at our show at the Arts Theatre next Monday. We heard from Matt White before the break there, chaps, and I don't know what you, some nuggets as ever when Matt White talks. He always he offers a lot of interesting insight. You know, the fact that his riders race fewer days than any other World Tour team, that they're not obviously tied to racing their home races because they're an Australian-based team, was interesting, I thought. And that whole process of putting, the spreadsheet together, I was surprised at how early he starts that, before the Tour de France, that he's tinkering with it all the time, and that no one else can edit it apart from Matt White.
Extraordinary stuff. It's very much like the Cycling Podcast Dropbox, isn't it? which we're not allowed to edit. Only Buffalo's allowed in there.
Oh, nonsense.
Buffalo has the password.
You're not allowed to delete anything. That's slightly different.
Well, actually, Daniel, you did delete a load of files, didn't you, on one occasion?
I deleted a whole archive once.
You did, yeah. And I had to.
Sorry about that.
Thanks to Dropbox. Exactly. It kind of proves the point.
My apologies.
Dropbox support managed to retrieve all my interviews with the Action Hagen Berman's team.
I mean, it's a good system, because you could imagine riders going in and just deleting, you know, their least favourite races, deleting themselves from the roster.
4 days of Dunkirk, yeah. Eneco Tour, they'd be popular ones.
Yeah. Yeah,
so to
Matt White would be thinking he's got everything sorted, and then no one turns up at the 4 days of Dunkirk.
Rich, as far as planning is concerned and that team, what's really going to intrigue me, I think, next year is to see, and maybe, you know, talking a bit more to Matt as well, and maybe a couple of the coaches at Mitchelton, is to see what sort of adjustments they will have made as far as the Yates brothers are concerned, because as I sort of playfully ribbed Matt White about this at one of our events, or I think our event at Harrogate actually, at the World Championships, the fact that over the last 2 years that unfortunately they've kind of fallen short of their expectations as far as the general classification in major tours is concerned. I think out in 5 out of 6 major tours with the Yates brothers. So Simon Yates obviously won 2018 Vuelta, but he lost the jersey spectacularly in the Giro in 2018. Adam Yates' Tour de France in 2018 didn't go too well. Simon Yates' 2019 Giro wasn't quite what he hoped and expected it was going to be. Same with Adam Yates' 2019 Tour de France. And in the Vuelta they didn't really have a GC leader. So I'm sure they know there's some work to be done as far as sort of timing the form peaks is concerned.
Yeah, I can enlighten you a bit there, because he told us on stage the other night actually that next year will look very similar to this year. Simon Yates will go to the Giro and then also go to the Tour, but probably not finish the Tour, because the Olympic road race is a big target for him next year. And again, Adam Yates will lead the team at the Tour, but I think that, you know, the following year there will be some changes, and I think the following year we'll see Simon Yates target the Tour. And Adam Yates might become more of a kind of one day and one week stage racer, I suspect. I think that the differences between them are becoming more apparent as they sort of mature. And in terms of temperament, it looks like Simon, you know, has the ability, but also the temperament for a 3 week tour. And Adam might, you know, evolve into a slightly different type of rider. But that seems to be the 2 year plan. Giro again for Simon Yates next year, Tour de France in 2021.
In a similar vein, Astana, I think, have made some decisions over the last couple of weeks, haven't they, about who's going to lead them where in 2020. I think they've decided that Fuglsang is going to be the leader at the Giro, and Superman is going to go to the Tour.
For the first time, Miguel Angel Lopez. Is that right? That is right.
Yep, his first Tour de France. So he can flatter to deceive there as well, having done so. Sorry.
He'll finish between 3rd and 9th.
Sorry, I didn't mean that.
Well, it should be a good Tour de France for him, of course, with a very sparse time trialing and the time trial on the penultimate day up to La Planche des Belles-Filles.
Finally, before we go, it was Raymond Poulidor's funeral this week. We talked about him with Francois last week, but you tweeted about him last week, Daniel. Just, I suppose he seemed one of these... Not hardly ageless, because he was an old man, but he was sturdy and you know, a robust looking character, wasn't he? And even despite his advancing years, I think it was quite a shock, especially as we'd all seen him so recently at the Tour de France, to hear that he'd passed away.
Yeah, he always looked in very good health at the Tour de France, and didn't really, you know, there was no noticeable sort of evolution, or there was no noticeable aging really over the last few years. He sat every day in his little kind of booth in the Tour de France start village, and was constantly being, well, he didn't see it as being pestered. He loved the attention. In fact, I think it was in L'Equipe a day or two after his death, I think they republished an interview they'd done with him in 2011, and he talked about the fact that his biggest fear in life was to no longer be be recognised, even sort of on a micro level. In the 11 months of the year when he wasn't at the Tour de France, he would sort of put his coat on and go out of his front door every morning, sort of hoping and praying that someone would recognise him and ask him for an autograph. And I suppose, you know, that says a lot about the sort of reciprocal relationship between him and the French public. They loved him, and he loved them.
And fame for him seemed to have no downsides. You know, his great success in life was to be loved and admired. Rather, he didn't have the sort of fame that maybe comes with winning. I think that, and he embraced that sort of status that he had, didn't he, as somebody who was loved for not winning much. Shall we wrap things up there, chaps?
We shall.
Looking forward to next week. As I say, tickets still available at thecyclingpodcast.com. You can also go there to order our new book, The Grand Tour Diaries. Click on book and you can get that delivered anywhere in the world.
Just on Monday's event at the Arts Theatre in Leicester Square, literally round the corner from Leicester Square Tube Station. So very convenient if you are in central London on Monday. And if you came to our show this Monday, just gone, don't worry, we're not doing the same thing. We've got a different lineup. Daniel will be with us, of course, as will Rod Ellingworth, new boss at Bahrain Merida, or Bahrain McLaren as they'll be, and Adam Blythe, of course, who made a six-part series, the Adam Blythe interviews, for us at the start of the year. And well, there'll be
a cameo
from Chiro, of course. He'll be buzzing in and then buzzing off again, I guess.
Yeah, well,
so it'll be different. So if you enjoyed Monday, come along again,
come back. Until Monday, Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Just finally, before we go this week, a little personal message from me. Pancreatic Cancer UK are the official charity of the year partner for the Ride London 100. That's the Prudential Ride London 100 in 2020. The charity is close to my heart because my mother passed away with pancreatic cancer in 2005. It's an awful disease, and I'm a proud supporter of Pancreatic Cancer UK. I will be riding Ride London to raise money for Pancreatic Cancer UK next year. You can get a place in Ride London through Pancreatic Cancer. They have just 100 places remaining, and they're offering Cycling Podcast listeners who join me on the ride a 50% registration fee discount. That doesn't mean you have to ride with me. That'd be quite slow for a lot of people.
You can ride the whole 100, the whole route of the
I'm going to ride the whole route.
Yeah, you're not going to just do half of it, are you?
No, I'm going to do the whole route. Just use the code MOORE50, MOORE50. Sign up at pancreaticcancer.org.uk/ride London. That's pancreaticcancer.org.uk/ride London.